Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. In December 1992, just before Christmas, 25-year-old Christy Mirak was brutally raped and murdered. The sixth grade teacher at Rorerstown Elementary School was getting ready for work when she was attacked. It was a case that shocked the region, but the investigation went cold. And even with renewed efforts by police over the years, 25 years went by without an arrest. Then last summer, a huge break in the case, comparing DNA from the killer to a genealogical database. 50-year-old Raymond Rowe was identified, arrested, and pled guilty to the murder earlier this month. This technology could be revolutionary in solving crimes and for other uses as well. Joining us on today's program to talk about the use of DNA and this technology, how it can be used, Craig Stedman, Lancaster County's District Attorney. District Attorney Stedman, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is Cece Moore. She's the Chief Genetic Genealogist with Parabon Nanolabs, the organization that assisted the Lancaster County District Attorney with identifying Christy Mirak's murderer. Cece Moore, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
By the way, saw you on television last night as part of Finding Your Roots. So I thought that the timing for us was great with you being on TV last night.
Great. Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to leave on Facebook, go to WITF's Facebook page to leave that. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, we're going to have kind of a segmented conversation here. Kind of chronologically go through this. Craig Stedman, let's talk about, I know you've talked about it on a program before, right after the case was cracked, but let's go back to December 1992 in Christy Mirak. What happened on that December morning?
So December 21st, 1992, Christy Mirak was a sixth grade teacher. She was getting ready to, she lived with a roommate in an apartment complex in Lancaster, Greenfield. And she was getting ready to go to work. Her roommate left for work at around 7 in the morning, so she was left alone. And then that morning, she did not show up. Her Principal Goodman, got concerned, and a couple hours later, actually went over to her apartment to see where, you know, what, if there was anything the matter. And of course, it was just the worst nightmares possible, and that he found her dead. In the living room floor of her apartment, her pants were off, her shoes were off, her underwear was off, her gloves and jacket were on, as if she was obviously getting ready to go, and there were clear signs of a struggle, and I instantly thought there was a sexual assault as well. So we did the crime scene, collected a number of samples, including some sperm samples from the carpet, and did what we could. We interviewed 1,500, maybe 2,000 people trying to solve this case, and we were really not getting anywhere. Of course, an autopsy was done of her. She suffered numerous injuries, facial fractures, her jaw had been broken. She had been, actually what killed her was strangulation. She had been sexually assaulted multiple times, and just an absolutely terrible death. So we had a horrible, nightmarish crime, killed in her own home. The teacher had no enemies. She actually had presents ready for her students to take to school that day at Christmas, and we just really were extremely frustrated, and that's an understatement. Just absolutely had the community riveted, haunted, as we had somebody that was capable of doing something like this out there, and of course it turned out to be a long time the person was out there.
The DNA that you had collected from the scene, in 1992, were you able to send that through the National Crime Lab, that it was actually be able to compare what was in the FBI's database?
Yeah, so DNA was evolving technology, and it's still evolving today, and I'm not necessarily the most expert on it, but yeah, we did everything we could with it at that time. We sent it to actually a number of different labs, and we did get results. It's just the numbers aren't the numbers that we ended up getting now, but we did have results. We just didn't get anything. So there's a national database called the CODIS, which is a federal mm-hmm. database, and eventually, you know, we put that sample in there. And what they do is compare the unknown samples from crimes like this with with DNA samples that are already in the database, and we did not get any results. So this was in the database. It was compared to others, and we weren't getting any hits on it.
Going back those 25 years, right after the killing, did you have any suspects in mind? I mean, did you identify anyone or more than one person that was a possibility?
We did, and we dozens and dozens of suspects. And when we say suspects, it just was a person of interest. I wouldn't even necessarily say suspect. We looked at countless individuals and kept doing that over the years as the police were just determined to solve this crime. And we used the same technology, actually, that solved this case to clear those individuals. So I can't remember the number, but it's definitely dozens of people that we took DNA samples from to clear it. And this case was unique in that we knew whoever had raped her, had killed her, given the circumstances, the crime scene, the DNA in her and actually on her. So we were going to be able to prove her murderer by finding her rapist. And, of course, that same technology, like I said, we used to clear a number of individuals. So we'd get their DNA if they had some kind of reason, we'd get it one way or the other, and people would consent to it. They didn't do it, and they'd be cleared. So we were really running out of avenues to turn, and eventually the East Lampeter Township Police Department turned it over to us the last couple years to take a fresh eye. Sometimes it just takes that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I know those in law enforcement don't like the word cold case, rather refer to it as an older case. But when did the trail go cold on this? When do you cross that line where you look at a case and say, wow, we're striking out all over the place, and we're not making any real progress here?
So we have, when we get the file, you have, actually at some point they just started keeping the file based on years, and you could see the different years of some years were 10 inches thick and some years were about a half inch thick. And they're just, as the years went by, we were running out of things to do. When we took over the case, we had a couple investigators look at it, prosecutor was looking at it, and we were just looking for different things. And we did some things. We interviewed a couple hundred more people trying to find any last thing. What else can we do? We were using some technology, and we were kind of at our wits' end. We felt like the police had done everything they could do. We took another look at it. We've done everything that we could do, and that really circled us in and ended up connecting us with what ended up solving the case.
Mm-hmm. I just want one more question about those 25 years. Give us a sense of, other than interviews, and I'm sure that there are people that were interviewed more than once, but other than interviews, what else can you do over that, and what was done over that 25-year period?
Yeah, so you really, when you get those cases, old, what do you even call them, cold cases or old cases, I mean, the best thing to do is just the old school. Just pick up the file, and this is something like 7,000 pages of reports, and you start reading it. That's the first thing you have to do. And just, is there something missed? Is there something? Because what happens is, we all do in our lives, you tend to make, there's this, I'm going to jump to this conclusion, I'm going to forget about the rest. So you have to start from page one of day one of the reports and go through it, and then you just make a checklist. Did we check this? Does this match up? Is there, in this case, we had descriptions of cars, and we started to take another look at that. Some people had seen some suspicious vehicles, which ended up being consistent with what he was actually driving at the time.
I was curious about that. Yeah.
So we had some pretty accurate descriptions on cars, but unfortunately, we found out that the registrations going back that far, when we tried to get them, were pretty much purged from the state, which was unfortunate. And again, it ended up working out for us, but we started looking to see if we could do anything with the vehicles. It really comes down to the interviews. In this case, like we said, we had the huge advantage of having the DNA. So we could clear people and we could solve it. It was just a matter of finding that right person.
All right. So that brings us to last spring and summer. As you said, you were pretty much at your wit's end. But what you decided to do, by the way, we should mention that there was a highly publicized case, the Golden State Killer, that was cracked using genetic genealogy. So tell me about getting the idea to approach the case this way, and how it all transpired from your end.
Sure. So actually was invited to somebody you know, Ed Marsco,
yes.
LDA of Dauphin County, put on a cold case seminar, just a training session. And my chief county detective and I, it was in 2016, decided to attend that. I never remember being on the fence. Did we have enough time to go? Did we not have enough time to go? And we did. And it was completely worth it because that led us to sending a couple investigators, the two main investigators on this case, to another training session, which they were introduced to what was coming out with this Parabon Nanolabs technology and what they could do, some new things they could do. And the first thing that we partnered up with them on was the phenotyping, so making the snapshot of what the killer would have looked like, an estimation based on ancestry, skin tone, eye color, hair color, that kind of thing. And I think you're familiar with it, and you saw what they ended up doing. So in October, November of 2017, we put that out in a public press release, and we got a number of tips. It didn't end up leading anywhere, but that had created the partnership with Parabon. And then in May of last year, they actually contacted our investigator and said, hey, we've got this new thing, which is going to lead us into Cece and what she ended up doing, which is just phenomenal, of genetic genealogy, and it might be able to help you in your case. So pretty much right after they came to us with that offer, their new technology, their new approach or new way of investigating cases, I authorized it. Yeah, let's do it. It's completely worth it. Let's give it. We didn't really, we literally said, well, there's nothing else for us that we can think of doing in this case. This is our last shot. Let's go forward with it. So I authorized the funds, and Cece did her work.
I'm going to bring Cece in just a moment. But I wanted to step back for a moment. So if you had not attended that seminar with then District Attorney Ed Marsico, now Judge Marsico, this may not have occurred.
Well, it wouldn't have occurred. It would not have occurred in this way. I think we were the third agency in the country or the world to end up making arrests based on this. So we wouldn't have been as early in the pipeline. And I think though, with more media and more press of more of these arrests, we eventually would have come around to it. But it wouldn't have happened as soon as it did. So. If Ed's out there listening, and thank you, that's the benefit of collaboration, of the DAs working together, of sharing information, things that they're doing, and just spreading the word, and so no, it wouldn't have happened in this exact way.
Mm. We're going to talk with Cece Moore about this in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing DNA and how it's being used, kind of a revolutionary way. And I don't know, maybe that's an overstatement. I'll ask Cece more in just a moment. But using technology today to solve crimes. Our guest today, Cece Moore, Chief Genetic Genealogist with Parabon Nanolabs, the organization that assisted the Lancaster County District Attorney's Office with identifying Christy Merrack's murderer. Craig Stebbin, Lancaster County District Attorney. A little bit later, we're going to be joined by Dr. Mitchell Holland from Penn State, who's a professor of biochemistry and molecular biology and a fellow with the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. That's coming up in just a few minutes. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Cece Moore, we're kind of approaching this as a storytelling thing. So as Craig Stebbin led up to when you were approached at Parabon Nanolabs about the Merrack case, take it from there. Let's start with how exactly, before we get into specifics of the Merrack case, how exactly does it work with what you have been doing over the last few months?
So I've been using genetic genealogy for about 8 years to help people of unknown parentage, adoptees, donor-conceived people, to find their biological parents and families and learn about their heritage. And so what we're doing is we're using someone's DNA to reverse engineer their biological identity or their genetic identity. And so that's applicable to any situation where you need to determine who someone is, who are their parents, who are their grandparents, etc. And I had used it in a case of an amnesiac who didn't know who he was in order to help him regain his biological and legal identity. And so it made sense that this had applications for law enforcement. And I had been approached dozens of times by law enforcement professionals over the years asking if I could use the techniques that I had developed for unknown parentage to apply to identifying perpetrators, killers, serial murders, that type of thing, in their cases. But it was still too early to do that until April of this year, after the Golden State Killer case arrest, that kind of opened things up, and that caused a website called GEDmatch, which is a public genealogy database that is a receptacle for raw data files from the consumer DNA testing companies. They were used unknowingly in that case and decided that they wanted to be supportive of law enforcement, and they changed their terms of service to explicitly allow this type of work in their database. And that's what I was waiting for. I've been involved with GEDmatch since inception. I'm good friends with the founders, and I've been one of the main promoters of consumer DNA testing companies to the public and getting people to upload their data on GEDmatch. So I wanted to wait until we had informed consent from the people participating in that database in order to use it for law enforcement purposes. Once that happened at the end of April, beginning of May, then it was a wide open, incredible opportunity to help bring answers to families of victims and some victims themselves, fortunately, that are still living from violent crimes. And I decided to join forces with Parabon Nanolabs because they're so innovative and forward-thinking, and create this unit. And so that is how this all started. And one of the very first cases that I was asked to work on, or invited to work on, was Christy Murak's case out of Lancaster.
Well, let's talk about that case specifically. So walk me through the process. You're asked to look into this case. How do you go about it? What is the process, and what did you find?
Well, the very first step is we have to go back to the original DNA, the original biological samples. And so it's really important that the agency or investigative agency has stored that DNA properly. And so they deserve big kudos for this, whoever it was who originally collected that crime scene DNA and stored that over the years so it was still viable for us. We can't use the earlier analysis that was done that Craig talked about for CODIS. When they analyzed it for that database, they only looked at between probably 13 and 20 genetic markers. And we're using advanced technology now to look at about 800,000 genetic markers across the genome.
Is that just an advance in technology?
It is, yes. So we're using what are called genotyping chips. There's a company out here in California called Illumina that started making those chips for health studies, for genome-wide association studies, they're called. And a company called 23andMe decided to offer that directly to the public to allow people to have access to their own genetic data. And so that is what we're using for these cases as well. And that didn't come about until, after 2000. It wasn't even available until more recently, and it wasn't available to genealogy enthusiasts till 2010.
So when you're talking about making comparisons with 800,000 samples out there, how quickly does this process go? You know, because I have to say this, and I hate to say it this way, but so many of us get our idea of what this like is from TV, where, someone puts it into a computer and boom, you know, within seconds they have a match, whether it's through CODIS or anything else today. How long a process does it take when you're making those kind of comparisons?
Well, so we're looking at those 800,000 genetic markers between this unknown subject, so this perpetrator of this crime, and then comparing it to about 1 million other people that have chosen to upload their raw data to this GEDmatch database and participate. So we're actually looking at about 1 million comparisons. And GEDmatch takes a couple of days, usually, from 8 hours to about 2 days, to compare that DNA sample or that DNA file that's been uploaded to everyone else. And what they're looking for are not just single marker matches. They're looking for long stretches of identical DNA. So where you're seeing lots of those A, T, C's, and G's line up for thousands of genetic markers, and so we're looking at blocks of shared DNA. So that takes a little while to process, you can imagine. That's a lot of computing power. In this case, it took about, I think, 12 hours from the time it was uploaded by Parabon before I had some matches I could look at. So what we're looking for are people who share these significant stretches of DNA with this unknown suspect. And if you share that type of DNA, then you have to have a relationship. You have to have a common ancestor. So you're cousins or you have some relationship like that, depending how much DNA is shared. And then that's when I take over. That's when I jump in and I say, okay, look, here we've got this list of people that share DNA with the suspect. They must be his relatives. So I need to figure out how they're related to him and how all the pieces come together and point at one, you know, particular individual, hopefully. Sometimes we have brothers, sometimes we have cousins, and then we have to turn that information over to the investigative agency. And it's really just a highly scientific tip that then they have to take and build the case like they did, like the district attorney's office did in this case. So it's a fairly long process. My work usually takes many, many hours of sitting and data mining, digging into that data. It's not automated beyond me getting that list of people that share DNA. Everything else is manual. I have to build all their family trees. I have to research those people, try to piece those families back together, and then find someone who is in the right place at the right time of the right gender and age to potentially be the suspect.
I mentioned seeing you on the Finding Your Roots program last night. I believe it was Ann Curry that there was like a 7% match for one of her great-grandfathers, I believe it was. And I have to admit that I was a little bit surprised that it was only a 7% match, and that was enough to say this is your great-grandfather. So in a case like, what do you use? What is the what's the bottom line as far as percentages go when you look at something and say, okay, here's a match with the DNA that has been collected?
So it's different than with CODIS, where you're looking for an exact match. With CODIS, you're looking for every marker to match, and you know it has to be that person. So the numbers in this case, as you heard, were, you know, astronomical as far as it being Raymond Rowe versus anyone else in the world. That's different than what we're doing. We're looking for people that share a part of your DNA, not all of it. So in Ann Curry's case, she had an unknown biological grandfather. Her father never knew who his biological father was. And so she would inherit about 25% from her grandfather. So we're trying to find someone that shares a portion of that DNA with her. So the DNA match you're talking about shared about 7% with her. Now that is equivalent to a first cousin once removed relationship or a half first cousin. If you think about it, you share 50% with each of your parents. You share about 25% with each of your grandparents. You share about 12% with your first cousins. And then you share about half that with a first cousin once removed. So that's what we were working with in that case. And so, you know, a lot of these cases, we might only have people that share 2% of their DNA, 1% of their DNA. And we have to find how all those people fit together in order to reverse engineer this person's family tree.
From what I understand, and tell me if this is accurate, and maybe you can tell me the percentage, that this was a half-sister of Raymond Rowe that had submitted DNA for genealogy purposes. Is that accurate, and what was the percentage of match?
For privacy reasons, I'd rather not go into those types of specifics.
Okay.
I know it's been discussed a little bit, but I'd rather not get into it. Just for the family's privacy.
I understand. All right, so Craig Stebbins, let me go back to you. As Cece said, at this point, it's the information is turned back to you, and there's more investigating that goes on. What happened at this point once you're armed with this information?
Right. So they give us a list of potential suspects that would match up, and we could eliminate some of them pretty readily based on age and some of the things she's describing. So we could focus on Ray Rowe, which we had no connection to Christy whatsoever, other than tangentially, which I could talk about later, but really no connection at all, was not on our suspect list, was not on our radar. But we don't arrest based on what the genetic genealogy says. We need a sample from him to compare to the sample from the crime, from the sexual assault. And so we made a couple attempts to get surreptitious samples from him. The first time did not work. I don't know whether he suspected something or not, but it failed. The second one, we used an undercover Pennsylvania State Police trooper at an event where he was a DJ, and he was actually DJing, and she got that some chewing gum and a cup. Water from him, and we sent that to the Pennsylvania State Police Crime Lab. And the Pennsylvania State Police Crime Lab, which is incredibly busy, put a rush on it and pretty quickly came back and said, you know, this is him. We have your guy, and it was a tremendous moment for us. So we suspected it, but to actually listen to it and hear it after, you know, 25 plus years of having this guy out there, Now we had great direction, and things were really starting to come together. Of course, that also made us nervous because when we got those results, he was actually on vacation across the country, and we were worried in this day and age of social media and how people could maybe accidentally share some information with a loved one, and then it would spread about actually apprehending him. But then we made the arrest actually on... Not on, so Parabon pointed us in the right direction. They solved the case for us, but the arrest is not actually made on their science. It's made on comparing the surreptitious DNA we got from him with the crime scene.
Time period between the time you got the information from Parabon and then you did the collecting of the chewing gum and the cup that he had had a drink out of and, you know, was arrested.
I think it was May 31st we got the surreptitious sample from him, and he was arrested on June 25th. And it would have been a little bit earlier than that, but we had to wait for him to come back from his three-week trip across the country. So the time period compared to how long we had waited for this was just quite incredible. I think May 1st is when Parabon called us and said, we offer this new service that CC has talked about. And so you're talking about less than 2 months after waiting for 25 plus years.
Why didn't you go get him?
When?
I said, why didn't you go get him?
So he was on vacation with his wife and his young daughter, adopted a daughter, and there's safety concerns. It was across the country, and of course, we wanted to interview him. We had the DNA, but there's still, we wanted answers, and we wanted to do that ourselves. So we had to weigh the benefits of potential flight. Would he find out about it? With what's best for the case. And there were, believe me, there were a number of discussions with a number of people involved about what was the best thing to do. And we also were concerned of the safety of the people he was with, that if we were going to, he knew he had done this all this time. He always knew. And he had committed one of the most brutal killings you could possibly have. So we knew what he was capable of. We were concerned with their safety. So we balanced security, flight, and also the investigative reasons. We decided to wait till he came back, and we put some surveillance on him, and it actually worked out really well.
I'm going to talk more about the DNA in just a moment, but some details here that I don't know whether they've ever been publicly discussed. Maybe so, maybe not. But for our audience... So he's arrested, and as you said, was interviewed. What did he say?
Well, he was actually, it was kind of a chilling to watch. We have video of the interview, and it was kind of chilling to watch him. He's very calm, very conversational, would joke around with the police officers. His short version was, I don't know who Christy Merrick is. I never met her. I don't have anything to do with her, and I have no idea how so much of my sperm was in her and on her. So... He had obviously thought about what he was going to say before. He was very, very calm. He acted completely. The word he used was baffled when he was confronted with how is your sperm, you know, in Christy and on her. And he said he was baffled by that. So the science, you know, speaks more loudly than his lies. So he accepted no responsibility. He acted like at first he said he thought it was a joke, that he was being arrested, one of those bail jail kind of things. He kept being told, look, this is no joke. And it certainly wasn't.
So did he, I mean, he pled guilty, but did he finally admit what he did?
Well, so to plead guilty, you have to admit in court that the facts that basically I gave at the beginning of the program are true. And so he did admit that, and he did plead guilty to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 60 years for the sexual assault crimes consecutive to that. So he admitted in court that he did it. He did not give an explanation or a reason, and I know that a lot of people want to know, but I just tell people, look, no matter what he would have said, it really wouldn't have mattered. He's a rapist, a burglar, and a murderer, and there's nothing he's going to say that was going to diminish his culpability.
Did this guy, as you said, he wasn't on the radar. Did he have a criminal record?
No.
Nothing?
No. He was a popular DJ in the mid-state. He apparently did a very nice job and was sought after for a lot of weddings and events, which, of course, makes it all that little bit more haunting that this guy was out there, came back into the community and became, you know, famous in the local area and was out there just living a life of fun, actually for longer than Christie was alive.
Is that unusual that someone without a criminal record would, you know, rise to the level of a rape and a murder and then not recommit?
I mean, obviously, it does stand out, and it's one of the things that we don't know. Just because he hasn't been charged with anything doesn't mean he did anything. I have no idea. Only he knows whether he committed another crime. I mean, if he did another crime like this and wore a condom, we wouldn't maybe be able to solve it. And so only he knows whether he has done anything else. It does. I mean, just the human reaction, people find it hard to believe that he hadn't done anything else. But we follow the facts and we follow the law, and the facts are he did in the law. So he did this case, and that's what we prosecuted him for.
CeCe, I'm curious about the personal feelings that you have when a case is solved like this. And from what I understand, you probably can give me an update, but from what I understand, at least 30 cases have been solved since last May using this technology. But what are your personal feelings when you hear a story like that?
Well, first let me say we've had 30 successful identifications. I don't use the word solved until they've pled guilty or they've gone to trial. We actually have 3 cases that I would consider solved because we've gotten guilty pleas and they're fully resolved, and we know who is guilty for sure in those cases. We still have a long way to go on the other ones. For me, this case was really personal. Christie's about my age. She's someone I feel like I would have really liked and been friends with, and she was killed right after I finished college. We were, you know, similar trajectories, personalities, all of that. And so it felt very personal. When I work on a case, I try to read as much about it as I can because you never know what hint or what piece of the puzzle might be important. And I learned that from Unknown Parentage work. You just never know which little thing will catch your eye and lead you to in the right direction or to the right person. And so I read all the interviews with her family. Her mother was a force. You know, her mother really wanted to keep Christie in the public eye and mind and help get this case resolved. And unfortunately, she died young, like so many of the mothers of these murder victims that I've seen. And she passed the mantle to her son, Vince, who has just been incredible. And so the family really inspired me in this case, as I know it did with the investigators as well, to try to get resolution for them and get answers and try to give them some peace after all of these years. I don't think we can provide closure really on cases like this. I don't think the victims' families can ever truly feel that, but at least answers finally and some peace, as I said. And so with Unknown Parentage, my work is also based on giving individuals and families answers and some type of closure. So it's similar in that way. But what is not similar is there's no happy endings in these cases. So that's more difficult for me. With adoption, with unknown parentage, there's a very good chance you're going to see a happy reunion. You're going to see people come together and their lives be enhanced by that. And in these cases, we can't undo what has already happened. And this was especially horrific. And so I felt really... of course, a lot of satisfaction to be able to help the investigators in this case and I've got to meet Vince Marek, Christy's brother. It's all been quite emotional. When I first realized that it had to be Raymond Rowe based on his ancestral mix, I mean the people that he's descended from, and also we were looking for someone that was half Northern European and half Puerto Rican, and he was the only one that fit. I just couldn't believe it was him, you know, because of what Craig said. He had this pretty high profile. There was a lot of information out there about him, and that's not the case with many of the people that I investigate to help research in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
I think you asked about him not doing other crimes, as far as we know, and that's the thing. In these cases, these are the people we're finding, people who did not apparently reoffend, or if they did, they didn't leave DNA at the crime scene, and that's how they got away with it all this time. So we are starting to see people more like Raymond Rowe being arrested for these crimes because they've stayed under the radar as far as their criminal behavior all of this time.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about DNA evidence and been talking a lot about the Christy Myrick murder case that was cracked and an arrest made and a guilty plea. Raymond Rowe going to prison for the rest of his life, plus some, without the possibility of parole for committing that murder. Our guest today, Craig Stedman, Lancaster County District Attorney, C.C. Moore, Chief Genetic Genealogist with Parabon Nanolabs. And I want to bring into the conversation now Dr. Mitchell Holland. He's a Penn State Associate Professor of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology and a fellow with the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Dr. Holland, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
You got to hear the whole story, and you may be familiar with the case anyway, but you got to hear the whole story of the Christy Myrick murder case. So your thoughts on what you've heard over the last 40 minutes or so?
Well, you know, what a wonderful outcome in this case. It's really why we as forensic scientists and, of course, Mr. Stedman as litigators and CC as a more as a genetic genealogist. I mean, it's why we do our work. And ultimately, what CC mentioned about the relationship with the family and bringing closure, that's a really important thing. It's terrible what happened to Christy, obviously, but bringing closure and being able to give the family some peace of mind in terms of knowing that the perpetrator is now behind bars, that's a huge thing. And I've been involved in cases like that over my career, and it's just it really is the reason we do our work.
So when I have to think, and I hate to keep going back to TV shows, but I would imagine since the advent of the CSIs, NCISs, all the programs, the police dramas, that the first thing they talk about is DNA evidence. That, you know, I think many people think that this is like a magic bullet. In some cases, maybe it is. But I would imagine as someone who is an educator that there was a lot more interest in forensic sciences than what there used to be, say, at Penn State and other schools as well.
You're exactly right. I mean, the shows have sort of created a career opportunity for individuals. So they see the shows and they think, okay, well, I can be a forensic scientist in my career. But, you know, from the perspective of DNA, in fact, you hit the nail on the head there. I was teaching students last night, and we were talking about forensic DNA applications. And one of the key things is that forensic DNA is an incredibly powerful tool. And there were elements here, different types of applications of forensic DNA analysis that have been talked about. And they're all really powerful, as you've seen, but not every case requires them. And so it's a challenge for investigators and litigators like Mr. Stedman that a jury may say, well, where was the DNA evidence in this case? And there may not be any DNA evidence, but there's still other strong evidence for conviction. So you have to be careful about being misguided that you have to have DNA analysis in every case. You really don't.
So even prospective jurors, go into a case thinking, where's the DNA? They're expecting to see something.
Exactly, and that's misguided because sometimes there isn't biological evidence in a case, and sometimes it's not needed even if there is biological evidence. And so It's really on a case-by-case basis how it's being used. Of course, in this case, in Christy Merrick's case, it was a critical piece of information that brought the perpetrator to justice.
From what I understand, and I mean, I think we got the sense of this just talking with Cece, that this technology has come a long way. Craig Stedman had mentioned that there was a good amount of DNA evidence in the Merrick case. But today, from what I understand, you can tell me about this, you don't need as much as DNA evidence as what was needed, say, in 1992, correct?
That's absolutely true, and in fact, I've been fortunate enough to have been around. I'm old enough now to have been around for the history of forensic DNA analysis. I joined the community back in the early 1990s, 1991, and it's been a fascinating process to watch how the technology has developed from the early days when the methods required really large amounts of high quality DNA. Perhaps, you know, a blood stain the size of a nickel. And today, you can take a blood stain the size of the end of a pinhead and do hundreds of DNA analyses on that amount of material. So, and then, of course, you have the technology that Cece Moore was talking about. And there are other technologies that have been developing over the last few years that are really going to further revolutionize forensic DNA analysis. And providing information like what Mr. Stedman mentioned in terms of ancestral information or phenotypic appearance type information. That's going to be more of a routine analysis. And then using public databases, of course, consent is important when you use public databases like Ms. Moore did in terms of solving this or helping to solve this case. And I would point out there that civil libertarians or civil liberties advocates will say that really everybody should be tested. Why should convicted offenders, why should that be a targeted group of individuals? Why doesn't everybody have a forensic DNA test done? And that's an interesting debate, right? Children have a blood sample taken at birth to do some genetic testing to see if they have any disorders that they need to address right away. And so there's genetic material there to do some form of genetic testing on that could be put in a database that we could use as a public database to help solve these crimes without having to wait for somebody to commit a crime or wait for somebody to join one of these genealogy databases.
And I wish I had more time to talk about that, but one thing I did want to touch on, and you've kind of mentioned this, we see the commercials for 23andMe, Ancestry.com. Ancestry is more toward genealogy and family ancestry, that kind of thing. But 23andMe does offer something that allows people to check into their genetics as far as medical conditions that you mentioned. You talked about babies being tested. This is something that years ago, again, was very expensive. Now, for $99, I'm not sure that's exact price, but someone can find out whether they're predisposed to diseases, illnesses. I mean, there's a lot of different applications for this.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, and you're right, the technology has become so precise, and we know so much more information now. We can get the information quicker, we can get it cheaper, and so there'll be a day not too long from now, you'll go to the doctor and they'll take a blood sample and they'll run it through the technology that we have available today and have a whole panel of information. How do you respond to pharmaceuticals in terms of, you know, which drugs should you be getting? What are you predisposed to in terms of any conditions or disorders or diseases that you need to be aware of? If you have a tumor mass, exactly what's happening in that tumor mass rather than just speculating based on the physical appearance of the tumor mass. It's just incredible the kinds of things that these new technologies are going to allow us to do, including applying it in forensic science.
Let's take a phone call from Norman in Lancaster. Norman, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my phone call.
Yes.
Two quick questions for CC. I assume there might be a lot of investor interest in Parabon. My assumption is that Parabon is probably a private company. Is there any consideration of Paragon going to turn themselves into a public company? And question number two, is there any things that CC can talk about as far as what Parabon might be working at or working on and looking towards the future?
Thank you very much. All right, Norman, thank you very much for your call. So we have a potential investor there, CC.
Well, it is a private company, but that's not really my area to discuss. I would say he should probably reach out to Steve and Paula Armantrout. They're the owners of the company, and so they can discuss that side of things. But they are working, you know, always working on really interesting projects there. They're not just working with law enforcement. They work with the federal government. They work on the reason I was first aware of them is they were working on a repatriation project where they were trying to help the government come up with kinship models to identify bodies of soldiers that are found overseas. So when they find remains overseas and we want to identify that soldier and give him, you know, give him a burial with his name and return him to his family, that is what first brought them to my attention. And then, of course, they're always working on their phenotype, their snapshot predictions where they can show us an approximation of what someone might look like. And so there's almost unlimited potential for that type of work.
I have a question here from another listener, Will emails. I contacted Parabon a few months back regarding a cold case in Philadelphia, the boy in the box, it's known in Philadelphia. I believe it was a baby's body that was found in a box years ago. Using the technology to figure out who the unidentified murder victims are, if the DNA technology can be used to find murderers and other criminals, is Parabon planning on trying to use the same to identify victims through last living relatives?
Yes, we are actively working on a number of cases. Those are called Doe cases, Jane or Joe, John Doe's, where it's an unidentified deceased person. There's approximately 40,000 of those individuals across the country. That was what I was first interested in using this for, actually not identifying murders and rapists. The boy in the box case is being worked on by Barbara Rae Ventner, that was the original genetic genealogist that worked on the Golden State Killer case. So it's being addressed, but many of these very old cases like that have degraded DNA, and so that presents its own challenges as far as trying to identify them. I do have a case that I believe we have gotten a positive identification on that hopefully will be announced publicly soon.
Oh, so you, is there any more you can tell us about it?
No, probably not, but there are quite a number of them. A lot of agencies are coming to us with those cases as well. So we're not just working on helping people get arrested. We're also helping to bring identities back to these people and bring those families answers as well on what happened to their loved ones.
Well, we're almost out of time. I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. Craig Stegman, I know that when CC said that they're being approached by a lot of law enforcement agencies, I know you were approached the same way after news broke about the Merak case. Are you still hearing from people from across the country who have questions?
Yeah, it obviously attracted a tremendous amount of media attention, and it should. And we hope that this message gets out among all the prosecutors and police officers. You know, don't give up on these cases. And you have just incredible work from Parabon. And my personal thanks, and thanks for the family. CC solved the case. She won't take it. She's very modest about it, but she solved the case. I mean,
the work you all did was incredible. I've never really, you know, interacted with law enforcement much in the past. I am amazed at your team there in Lancaster. Just incredible work, truly.
Well, thanks. And we never forgot this case. And it was one of the things that it took place a year after I started. It bothered me. It haunted me. And to have this kind of thing, and she talked about the family and her father, is just super, one of the nicest guys you ever meet. Vince stayed with this case, the son, absolutely made a huge difference for us. And hopefully, you know, going forward, we're going to be partnering with Parabon in some other cases. We hope we can have some success, but at least we're going to try. And there's a lot of other victims out there.
I only have about 30 seconds left. I understand that you have started, I don't know, an old case.
Yeah,
unit?
So we, in response to this, really from what they've done, we've just reformed some of our unit. We have the prosecutor that worked on this case and the two investigators that worked on it, as well as our forensic sergeant. We have an old case unit, and we're going to put some money in this and see what we can do. But Parabon's made a great difference for us.
Thank you all for being with us today. Craig Stebbin, Lancaster County District Attorney, C.C. Moore, Chief Genetic Genealogist with Parabon Nanolabs, Dr. Mitchell Holland at Penn State University. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to hear a story of a Pennsylvania serviceman who was killed recently in Afghanistan.